It's the Vancouver's doomed edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, muting the immune system, baby pains, UN statehood, and ways Vancouver can meet its doom. Let's begin episode 133.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
Joining you again is Jenna, your biochemist.
So, Don, Jenna, how was your week?
Ethan, Don.
My week was peppered here and there with skeptical thoughts and dreams.
Skeptical thoughts and dreams, eh?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'd rather not share.
Okay.
My week was stunning. I'm just learning about, you know, the importance of denoting and what it actually means to have a subject and a referent. And so for any of those, if I go off on a tangent and I start talking weird, I'm taking a course this semester on the philosophy of language, which means things that normal people don't think are important, we tend to delve into quite a bit. And every so often, it's like, how do I know you are you? In the sentence, you are you.
I'm me. You're you.
Not in the
remind me to invite you to dinner, Don.
It's not in the metaphysical sense of whether you exist, but in the sentence, you are you. What exactly are the parts, and what do they mean, and why do they mean?
Well, speaking of parts.
Speaking of parts, something I would like to share is some new research that's being done into the flu. So as we come into flu season and the campaign start as far as vaccinating those who are susceptible to the flu and stuff, lots of us start to wonder about what we're going to do when inevitably we start to feel that tickle.
Do you get vaccinated for the flu?
I haven't yet. I don't have a really good reason one way or another. I just get sick and then I get over it. I'm fairly immunocompetent though.
Yeah, last few injection I got was the H1N1, which I had to get for moral reasons because we were strong supporters of that.
Well, the H1N1 was different because we were actually the danger zone for the first time in a flu season in a long time, since the Spanish flu.
I think I got the H1N1 flu. It wasn't actually typed, so I can't say for sure, but the symptoms were consistent with what had been shown in other people, and I ended up taking the Tamiflu or the antiviral medicines.
I know that when I got the shot, I had a number of reactions, you know, my body responding to the flu. What kind of things would one expect to have happen?
Well, sometimes a vaccine, depending on the type of vaccine, will actually elicit some of the responses of getting the actual illness itself. I know I did not feel particularly wonderful after getting a vaccine for yellow fever. But scientists are studying a new way to help decrease the damage that's caused by the actual infections with the influenza virus, and also to decrease the rate of death that's caused by this virus. So most of us, when we think of getting the flu, we think of spending a few days on the couch and hoping that there's someone there to feed us soup. But as we were talking about susceptible populations and people with immunosuppression and people, the elderly, small children, can actually have a significant source of mortality for these people can actually be getting the flu. So the new therapy that the scientists are working on doesn't actually target the virus. It targets you, and it doesn't boost the immune response or sort of prime the immune response like a vaccine does, but it actually suppresses part of the immune response. So when you're infected with the influenza virus, i.e. you catch the flu, which is not a stomach virus, as some people still seem to think, but actually a respiratory illness that you experience in your lungs, one of the things that happens is a very strong immune response. This includes a hefty inflammatory response, which is initiated through cytokine signaling.
When you say inflammatory, do you mean they go up to you and say, boy, you're ugly and I really don't like you? When you say inflammatory, what do you mean by inflammatory?
So, yes, the viruses do not, in fact, talk to you. So let's first start going through... Very skeptical in nature. So let's go through a bit of background on what inflammation really is and what it does and what causes it. So we've all experienced inflammation. So the cardinal signs of inflammation are sometimes remembered by the very strange mnemonic device. I think it's strange. Prish. I've never used that word myself, but anyhow.
Are you allowed to say that on radio?
I don't know. We'll check with our producers. But it stands for pain, redness, immobility, swelling, and heat. So, for example, if you stub your toe and it turns all red and throbby-like, that is inflammation.
Is throbby-like a technical term?
You betcha. I wouldn't use anything less. Inflammation can be caused by all kinds of things. So basically stubbing your toe or freezing your fingers a bit or anything else that causes tissue damage but doesn't introduce foreign bodies. This induces what's called sterile inflammation. And it just means that it's inflammation without an external cause. No sort of external pathogen coming into your body. Whereas bacteria, viruses, sand, the pointy bits of throwing stars, really anything else can induce inflammation when it's introduced into your tissue where it's not supposed to be.
I suspect, based on your examples, all inflammations are equal. It strikes me as pointy stars being, I don't know, a little worse than stubbing my toe on the corner.
Although I'm not sure it's the inflammation about the throwing stars that's significantly worse. It's probably the direct tissue damage that it causes, you know, going into various organs.
Blood loss and all.
Yeah.
The horde of ninjas behind you.
Yes. So our body doesn't, you know, make our toes throb for no reason. So the purpose of inflammation is to respond to damage. And so parts of the inflammation response are important for neutralizing any threat and also with initiating the healing process. Cells that sense damage or foreign invaders release cytokines into your system. So these are chemicals that initiate the inflammatory response. And it's basically the... You can think of inflammation in general as flushing the area with fluid, so blood and blood plasma, and this causes the redness and the swelling and the heat because you're increasing this body temperature blood in a specific area.
So is the throbbing then you feel actually just your pulse?
Yeah.
As it's going through this tight...
Yeah, because you're basically, yeah, just increasing the pressure of liquid in that particular body part. Another component of the inflammatory response is recruiting cells that are involved in the innate immune response. So we all have cells floating around in our blood all the time and in different tissues as well that are part of the innate immune response that are basically always ready to respond to an external threat. And so the inflammatory response is involved in recruiting these types of cells to the site of the damage so that they can do their job and neutralize that threat. And the whole process is involved in, yeah, just trying to flush stuff out, trying to neutralize the threat and start the healing process. So inflammation really has to be balanced, though. So when I talk about, you know, threats being neutralized and helping healing and stuff by this process, you might think, oh, well, maybe then we want sort of chronic inflammation all the time. But as you might notice, we don't actually walk around all swollen and red and throbbing all the time. And this is because while this reaction can really help to quickly mitigate an infection when it first happens. Sustained inflammation or a really strong over-the-top inflammatory response can cause damage to our tissue because we're not designed to sustain this kind of response and the chemicals and that kind of thing that are involved as well as temperatures and extra pressures for long periods of time. And it causes tissue damage and it can cause tissue death and other nasty complications. So, for example, allergies, including anaphylactic responses, atherosclerosis, asthma, and rheumatoid arthritis are really just a very small sample of the types of illnesses that can result from badly regulated inflammatory responses in our body. So the bottom line is we need this response to be able to deal with the threat of incoming pathogens, but if it's not balanced, it can result in a lot of damage to our own tissues in our own body. So in the flu, most of the damage that's caused in our sicknesses is actually due to collateral damage that's caused by the body's own inflammatory or immune response, rather than damage directly caused by the multiplying virus. So influenza infection is specifically characterized, as opposed to other infections, by really eliciting a very strong inflammatory response in the lungs. And this is the underlying cause of much of the mortality caused by this virus. So basically, your body's overreacting to the viral threat of the flu and causing this massive cytokine storm. And yes, it really is called a cytokine storm. So it gives you sort of an idea of what's going on chemically. And this starts an aggressive inflammatory response, causing lots of tissue damage. And then this exacerbates the inflammatory response more. So remember that tissue damage itself, like when you stub your toe, can have this inflammatory response. So when, an inflammatory response is started by the virus, and then that causes tissue damage,
which is a feedback loop.
Yeah, exactly. This big cascade that, as you can imagine, can cause a lot of damage. And it results in a lot of the death associated with flu that we see all over the world every single year. So the authors of a new paper in Cell point out that most of the ways we fight the flu is with the vaccine, which has limited utility if the virus is spreading more quickly than the vaccine is spreading geographically that can target it. We also have antivirals that can be used after the fact, but these are sort of limiting infection at later stages, whereas the inflammatory response happens quite rapidly. So also antivirals like antibiotics that target bacteria are only useful for a limited period of time, so only a few months or years, because you get drug resistance in the viral population because it is able to mutate so fast. We've talked about this a little bit in the context of HIV infection. And if you want to know a little bit more about how resistance can develop, you can check out my latest post on andthatscience.ca, a blog where I talk about some of these things. So the scientists in this new paper in Cell are looking at a way of decreasing the death associated with flu by suppressing the inflammatory response that causes a lot of this mortality. Basic idea is to limit the part of the immune response that causes the damage while letting other parts of the immune response deal with the infection. So again, we need this type of response because we need to be able to neutralize that viral threat. So you don't want to kill the immune response altogether, but you want to be able to sort of mitigate the parts of it that are causing damage to ourselves. So these scientists found out that, contrary to what was thought previously, you don't necessarily need a strong inflammatory response to recruit the cells that you need to neutralize the virus particles. So in other words, you can kill the viral infection without such a strong inflammation that can kill you. So they also found the specific receptor that's responsible for the initiation of the cytokine storm, and they found chemicals that were able to modulate this activity, such that there were mice that they infected with virulent influenza, and these were able to fight infection, but still have lower levels of inflammation, and it reduced the mortality associated with the infection. A major benefit to this type of approach is mitigating damage after infection. So if you haven't been vaccinated, like me most years, or it's a different strain than the vaccine supported that year, you're not automatically screwed. So as a bonus, we've talked about how viruses can mutate again to quickly mitigate the effects of drugs and become resistant to them. But this drug targets a human protein, and we don't really mutate that fast because, I don't know about you guys, but I don't reproduce that fast. Certainly not as fast as most bacteria. And so the receptor that they're targeting is really unlikely to mutate, and this means that resistance to this kind of therapy isn't really expected. So this drug would be expected to be able to be used for a long period of time, and also for potentially mitigating different causes of inflammation that still cause human disease. So basically, it takes two to tango, and the host organism is just as much a participant in infection as the invader, whether it be viral or bacterial. So if it's hard to target the invader, which it is when you take into consideration how fast they evolve, you can target the host. And this is a good example, I think, of thinking outside the box, medically speaking, and considering suppression of the immune system as a really viable solution in a therapeutic context, even in the face of an invading pathogen.
I'm curious if this could be adapted for other purposes where we want to suppress the immune response, like organ transplant or something.
Well, so the types of immunosuppressant therapy that are used for that kind of thing where you're trying to really say, you know, immune system shut up and go away, we're doing something different over here, is not really what this is about. As I was saying, this isn't suppressing the entire immune response. So what they found in these mice is that the cells, the immune cells that deal with external bodies and recognize things that are non-self and destroy them, those were still active in this response to the virus. It's just that the inflammatory cytokines and the stuff that causes all that inflammation was suppressed so that there wasn't as much tissue damage directly caused by inflammation, but you still get that foreign body response. And so in something like organ donation, where there's a whole bunch of not me happening, you would need to further suppress the immune system to be able to avoid rejection.
Mm. Right. So this isn't actually muting the immune per se. It's muting the inflammation response.
It's more like, I think of it as more immune modulation than immune suppression. Because what we're doing is sort of fine-tuning the levels of the different types of response that are associated with a pathogen coming in. And specifically, the reason they're looking at flu again is because for some reason the flu virus specifically is really good at producing this massive inflammatory response.
All right. Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. And when we come back, we'll discuss more. So stay tuned for that.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you. And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, what's up in skeptical news?
Well, you know, I was reading a couple articles about pain, in particular, baby pains. They were doing some research into how and when babies feel pain. Now, of course, you have to wonder, how do these researchers, you know, how do they ask the preborn, and this is their subject group, if they feel pain or not? I mean, it's not as if they can actually say, oh, yes, yes, I do, or no, I don't.
Kick once for yes, kick twice for no.
Kind of. What researchers essentially relied upon is brain activity recorded by an electrocephalogram, EEG. An EEG is when you take readings of the electrical activity of the brain via electrodes placed on the scalp. Now, of course, when I first read this article, I was sitting there kind of wondering how they would get inside to put the little hat on the preborn. But I believe what they were doing actually is they were focusing on premature babies, which is how they actually had access. Because if they didn't, I think that's an entire segment all into itself to try and figure out how you would put the little cap on the little fetus inside the womb. That being said, the EEG recordings of infants between the ages of 28 and 45 weeks gestation show that the brain begins to produce a distinctive response to simple touch versus a clinically essential heel ant, i.e. when you're born, they do a little slit at the bottom of your foot, and I think they collect blood samples, the main reason why they do it. At about 35 to 37 weeks, babies' due date are based upon roughly a 40-week pregnancy, although babies are generally considered to have gone full term if they make it to 37 weeks. According to the researchers, recent studies have emphasized the importance of burst neuron activity, i.e. little brainstorms in the head, and how this has an importance in determining the formation of functional brain circuitry. Essentially, what they were trying to do is trying to locate is if these burst activities create the brain circuitry, or are they a response to formations that are occurring within the brain. Basically, what they've determined is that the more sort of knocking around you get, the more malformed your sensitivity will get. So essentially, premature babies tend to have a situation where they're either very much more sensitive to pain or very much less sensitive to pain. And their research was attempting to try and figure out why this is doing it. And they discovered that the more sort of pain stimulus you get in this critical period of time between, 35 to 37 weeks, can alter the way your sort of brain's pain circuitry work. Essentially, the main reason why I thought this was interesting, above and beyond the idea about, you know, how do we determine how the brain functions, and essentially what this research has done, it says that the neurons, the brain complexes for creating pain or for us understanding pain occur, like I say, roughly 35 to 37 weeks, which is almost the time you're popped out of the oven, so to speak, and you're done. This became interesting for me because quite often I will have discussions with people who are anti-abortion, or you hear about the debate between anti-abortion and pro-choice. And one of the memes in that particular area is that the fetus feels pain, and therefore abortion is innately inhumane. Of course, on the other side, you have those people who say, listen, until it's out of the oven, so to speak, it has no feelings, it doesn't count as anything. And I thought this was an interesting way we can actually take science to help determine exactly at what point are we ethically right or wrong when it comes to the idea of abortion, at least vis-a-vis inflicting pain. Now, of course, like I say, the study wasn't intended to do that, but it does show that those people who claim that abortion, and most abortions occur pre-16 weeks, very rarely does it happen after that. In fact, after 22 weeks, it's under extreme circumstances that an abortion is ever performed, and that's usually because one or the other's life is in imminent danger. I guess the mother's life is in danger. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So again, this just struck me as an interesting case to sit there and say, so when do we actually start to feel pain? And it appears to be much later than we thought.
But so are they feeling pain in this 35 to 37 week period, or does that mean that their brains are being formatted to feel pain later when they're born?
So what the study was showing is that the fetus feels something.
Hmm.
But what's the difference between just feeling a sensation versus feeling pain? And based upon neural activities of people you can ask, they have sort of a pattern of what the brain looks like, certain parts of the brain look like when you experience pain. And they go back through the gestation period to when these particular structures sort of disappear, when you no longer get this sort of spike that would account to pain, but you still get the little spike that says, hey, it felt something. Hmm. So in the one sense, I guess you could say, is there a response to touch in the fetus pre 35 weeks? Yes. Does this response equate to pain? No, as far as we understand. Again, this is one research amongst many.
Right, right.
And so the other thing that I just wanted to clarify, so this study found that the most critical sort of time period for normal sensory stimulation as far as that baby being able to, when it grows older, feel pain normally, was while these circuits were forming as opposed to before that?
Exactly. And again, the focus of this research was to explain why premature babies will tend to have a malformed neural system when it comes to pain. And the hope of this study was to help in how do we treat premature babies when they're born. And basically they're saying we need to be much more sensitive to the idea of how we treat them, because mm-hmm. if we do inflict pain, even if it's for good reasons, that will actually not only cause pain, but can actually rework the circuitry of the brain by doing it.
Cause a sort of a dysfunction of pain circuitry that's much longer lasting than their days in the
sort of
NICU. It makes me wonder whether or not at the onset of very premature labor, once it becomes, you know, obvious that this baby is coming out, whether a prudent way to go to make the baby basically to treat it as gently as possible might be to perform a careful C-section as opposed to a vaginal delivery.
Well, and actually that's one area of interest. Now, I'm not quite sure, pre 35 weeks sort of thing, they're sort of saying, well, no, it's not going to make a difference. So if you want to
go natural childbirth. Well, I guess you're pretty small to like shoot out there.
And if you're a late term sort of birth, right? I mean, again, 45 weeks is actually quite a long time. Forgive me, I always thought pregnancy was 9 months, but apparently I was off on that because 9 months equals anybody?
Nah.
36 weeks.
I got nothing.
So it's like we're talking 10 months.
No, it's not.
Come on.
No. Every second month is like a week and a half, and you got. No. 36? Give me a break.
So, but the point being is that that this does help define not only, you know, how do you treat birth itself, because you are right. I mean, when do you do a C-section, when not? Mm-hmm. I suspect premature births revolve around the, oops, there it is, sort of situation. Or again...
I think in some cases, I think labor can still be prolonged in premature births, depending on the circumstances.
But from what I understand, most medical researchers want to keep it in there as long as
possible.
Oh,
yeah, you're going to hope that's false labor.
Yeah.
For shiz.
Which is why, like I say, if a premature baby is born, it's usually, oops, look, it's out already. What are we going to do? It's not like you can return to sender.
No, you can't.
No.
Well, before we get on to the doom of Vancouver.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Dawn, one more piece of skeptical news that caught our eye.
Just a second. I'm going to crawl under the desk.
I don't know. What? Some people may or may not have heard that the Palestinians are going to the UN looking for statehood. Some may ask why I think this is a skeptical issue. As our loyal listeners know, one of the aims of Radio Free Thinker is to extend the boundaries of skepticism, to apply, as well as possible, the tools of critical thinking, scientific objectivity, and reason. To that end, I thought it was useful to give a quick outline of what is expected to take place this week from a polyskeptic sort of point of view. In the next week or so, the Palestinian government is going to approach the UN to vote on the status of Palestine. Is it a nation state or not? The initial target is to go to the Security Council, which must recommend a likely candidate for state membership to the General Assembly. The Assembly itself cannot actually extend membership to the UN. If the Council approves, Palestine becomes a member state of the UN and as such gains the rights and privileges that imbues.
Can I ask a really ignorant question from the science lab? Not to say all scientists are politically ignorant, but I feel ignorant on this issue. What kind of government does Palestine currently have? What kind of governing body, what class of government is currently there?
That's actually one of the main reasons why they're pushing this forward, is because it is sort of a semi-autonomous state. With an ambiguous, because technically Palestine is occupied territory and has no official government, no official statehood. And one of the things it's trying to do is to sort of force the issue. And actually, I'll go into that a bit later, if you bear with me. Because one of the other things I thought was interesting about this was, again, the idea of statehood and nationhood and the UN itself. There are actually several classes of membership to the UN. Most known is member states. Those are recognized independent nations that are accepted as members of the UN. In order to become a member state, as I say, a candidate must be recommended by 9 of the 15 members of the Security Council. And then the General Assembly votes, and if the candidate gets a 2/3 majority there, they become a member state. However, there are lesser classes of membership. There are non-member permanent observer states, a nation that can observe and speak at the UN but does not actually get a vote. There are also non-member observer entities, one of which right now is the Palestinian Authority.
And the Vatican?
Actually the Vatican, which I was going to mention as a surprise later, is a non-member permanent observer state. It's the only one in existence right now.
Hmm.
So the Palestinian Authority is an example. There are also observer organizations such as the EU, other intergovernmental organizations such as Interpol, and NGOs like the Red Cross. Now, the Palestinians are experiencing extreme pressure from the U.S. not to get this vote and stated that they will veto the request. The U.S. and Israel state that the only way for Palestine to gain statehood is through negotiations with Israel. The Palestinians rebut this point by pointing at 40 years of occupation, continued expansion of Jewish settlements of land, and in theory, innumerable failed negotiations showed Israel doesn't really want the state to be independent. We talked about this before with the idea of an apartheid state, and we won't get into that too much. But from their point of view, the only option they have left now is to go to the UN and be recognized as a de facto state, and with the legal rights and moral capital that this status would occupy, would grant them, they could actually negotiate as equals and perhaps come to a successful resolution. One right of member states is to have a defined territory, something negotiations have yet to achieve. As I had stated, the Palestinians, you know, expect to fail in gaining actual statehood because the Security Council, it won't pass that. The U.S. has a veto. However, the Palestinians are hoping to plan to go to the General Assembly and get the vote to succeed there, where they do have apparently enough votes to do this, and they will become, as I say, a non-member permanent observer state, such as the Vatican. They already have a non-member permanent observer status as an entity, but not as a nation state. And to go back to answer your question again, right now the whole concept of Palestine was originally settled in 1948 with a UN resolution that said there's going to be two states created out of what was called then Palestine.
Yep.
That became complicated by a series of wars. And then what evolved into what we now consider to be the Palestinian state was, I think, a 1967 or 19, I can't remember the date of it, resolution that again said that Israel exists here, the occupied territories is an independent state of Palestine, but only in the General Assembly, so it never really became a state.
What I was actually wondering about is more the nature of the governing body itself, you know, as far as dictatorial or democratic or monarchical.
So the Palestinian Authority is actually sort of broken up into two parts. Technically, it's one government, that of the West Bank and Gaza. Political infighting has sort of made it de facto two states. Gaza has Hamas, which you hear about, which again was a democratically elected government. So it's a government like we think of a government, with a prime minister and that sort of thing. The West Bank is the same thing. It also has an elected government called Fatah, which evolved out of the PLO, which was at the beginning a terrorist organization. Sort of like Sinn Féin is to the Irish Republican Army, Fatah is to the PLO. Sort of a similar bank. One of the things that makes it complicated, although they have limited political authority in the occupied territories, they have very little military authority, and they have actually no control over their purse strings, per se. They rely a lot on international donations to actually fund the government functions, schools, that sort of thing. And they rely on
barbecues.
And they rely on customs duties, but the customs duties are administered by the Israelis. And the foreign income that the Palestinian states gets comes through Israel. So Israel controls the purse strings, it controls the military strings. And this has complicated the whole, when will Palestine become a proper state? And from the Palestinians' point of view, Israel doesn't want to settle this question because it has much more advantage in maintaining the status quo, and this is their way of saying, you know, we're too weak on our own to do it, but if we get world opinion on our side, then maybe we can. And by and large, almost every UN vote that is in favor of Palestinian statehood is like 99% in favor of that. There's usually like the United States and Israel and sometimes one or two other rogue nations who are, you know, they need some money from somebody, so they're saying, hey, give us some money and we'll vote with you, that vote against it. And because the UN has veto, it never amounts to much.
U.S.
Sorry, yes.
Okay, then. Well, why don't we go to one more commercial break, and then we'll discuss how Vancouver will meet its doom.
Doom!
Stay tuned for that.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
I'm the star standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star. The planet is just another speck. To think about all of this.
Radio Free Thinker is heard Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFPX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
We're all connected to each other.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, we're discussing how Vancouver will meet its doom.
Doom!
Yay!
Yes. You know, sometimes I wake up in a cold sweat wondering just about the future of this fine, fair city I've adopted. And one of the things, you know, that rarely comes to mind are volcanoes. Volcanoes are one of the hidden threats to Vancouver that many people don't realize. North of the city is the Garibaldi Volcanic Belt, which is a series of volcanoes, that started erupting 1.3 million years ago, with the most recent being 12,000 years ago. Many people don't realize that actually over 2,000 people were killed, in geologically terms recent, by a volcanic explosion north of Terrace, BC in the 1700s. Garibaldi Mountain is less than 100 kilometers away from us. Some people believe that the periodicity of Mount Garibaldi, periodicity is the time it takes between volcanic eruptions, is actually long overdue, that there might be an eruption any day. But again, this is in geological terms, so we're not talking this week or next week. We're talking this millennium or next millennium sort of thing.
I don't know, because I was watching this cartoon, and this guy told me that there's a volcano headed our way. Sorry.
It's okay.
I should stop believing The Simpsons.
Mm. Awkward segue. It is one of the most, actually, Garibaldi itself is one of the most watched sites by the Geological Survey of Canada. Again, we are talking Canada. I don't want to overplay the threat here too much, but I thought it was kind of interesting. Of course, those places most likely to be wiped out if Garibaldi does explode aren't actually Vancouver, but Whistler and Squamish. We here in the GVRD, though, could be subjected to flash floods as a result of melting glacier ice on the mountains, and ash clouds that could not only blanket the land with toxic ash, but also pollute our water supply and cut us off from external help.
And also obscure the airport and cause a massive backlog of flights.
True that.
Yes.
And that could really reach globally.
Although I think that's only Icelandic volcanoes that do that.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Yeah. I think ours are more civilized.
You're discriminating.
Yeah. Well, Garibaldi, of course, is a homegrown threat. And as I kind of say, you know, the likelihood of it erupting in our lifetimes is not that great. But just over the border are two mountains that are considered to be some of the most likely places in the world to erupt, Mount Baker and Mount Rainier. Now, neither one of these will result in a lava flow near us, but their closeness does raise the risk of ash cloud. Mount Baker itself is only about 200 kilometers away as the crow flies.
Right.
So, you know, what would you do if you were sitting there and you heard on the radio that a volcano had erupted? Okay. First, you should do...
Text my mom.
You should be prepared. Everyone knows to be prepared. Now, of course, I'm not going to go over the standard, you know, have a stockpile of food, bottled water, canned air, that sort of thing. No, that's probably been covered quite a bit from our other likelier disasters. What most people need to do is to become acquainted with the terminology geologists are and the like are likely to use. If you know what they are telling you, you'll be much better able to prepare what is the best action for you to follow. So here's some important words you might hear in the event of an eruption. Pyroclastic flow. This is fast-moving current of superheated gas up to 1,000 degrees and rock, which can reach speeds from the volcano of up to 700 kilometers an hour. The flows normally hug the ground and travel downhill along valley paths and that sort of thing. Their speed does depend, of course, on the density of the what's coming out of things. But this is one of those things that if you're in its way, again, you're toast. There's just you're not
toast, quite literally, actually. Yes.
Yeah, you can't run 700 kilometers an hour.
No. If you go Google pyroclastic flow on the internet, you'll see them go, and it's quite dramatic to see, but horrifying too.
Also, do not believe Dante's Peak that you can outrun one of these suckers.
No, but you might be able to outrun a lahar. A lahar is a mud flow of debris that flows, basically, it's from the slurry and the excess from the pyroclastic debris itself, rock debris, water, and that tends to flow down river valleys. Essentially, think of this as a massive flood of concrete coming at you. It's much more solid. It's not like a flood. This is like a solid lump of concrete smacking you. Very, very powerful and very dangerous to anyone.
So although you might be able to outrun it, if you're real fast, it might be a better idea to get out of the way first.
Yeah, move up instead of along the valley floor. That would be. And then, of course, there's volcanic ash. These are small dust particles, pieces of rock that are erupted into the air with volcanic acid. These ashes are highly acidic and decompose fabric, corrode metal, clog machinery, and block water flow. And probably not very good for your air conditioner either. Volcanic ash kills animals and plants on the roof. It can build up to such a weight as to cause buildings to collapse. We've seen this with Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines a number of decades ago. When mixed with water, the volcanic ash can become like a cement and literally freeze you in place. It's like you're dunked in cement, and actually you can suffocate from it. So know your terms. Second, know what your local risks are. If you live in Whistler, are you in a potential lava flow path? Are you in a possible pyroclastic flow, flooding? Third, have a place to evacuate to. We were talking beforehand that some people have particular times that they'd like to have a natural event happen because it would seem to be less burden on them if it happened that particular time. But not only that, but knowing where to go in the event. It's just to work out. So there's a disaster that hits Vancouver. Where are you going to go? Because when authorities tell you to leave, you need to leave. Fourth, if you're indoors, close the windows, close the doors, turn off the fans, the heaters, the air conditioner. Again, expect the air to be filled with volcanic ash, and that can be quite bad. At least indoors, you'll be protected from that. Don't forget to bring your pets indoors. If you're outdoors, obviously get indoors or under a shelter. If you live near rivers or streams, move to higher grounds. I mean, ultimately, it's kind of hard to give you a definitive thing, but if you check out our blog, there will be a number of links to actually teach you what to do in an event of a volcano. Now, of course, volcanoes are very famous.
Just before we move on from volcanoes really quick, I would just like to say that there's, something we don't say on Radio Freethinker very often, and that, it's good to really think critically about what you're hearing and, understand what the terminology is and weigh, what you think you should do. But I'm thinking that in the event of a volcano, using a little less critical thinking and a little more listening to what the experts are telling you might be a really good idea. I know personally, if there's a volcano warning and an expert is going to tell me what to do, whether or not I hear the word pyroclastic flow, I'm listening to that guy.
I don't know. That might be a perfect opportunity just to say no. They're telling me this one thing. I'm going to wait for the physical evidence to prove one way
yep,
or the
other. There's the lava.
That's where we turn into our own right. Personal lawn ornaments.
Well, the good thing is the Garibaldi volcanoes are generally considered unlikely to erupt for the time being. I think Don mentioned sort of geographic time frame here, right? In the past 2 million years, the volume of erupted material from the Garibaldi belt has been less than 10%. And compared to the U.S. states of California and Oregon, which have the more active volcanoes, they're more about 20%. So even statistically speaking, we have a kind of a smallish
volcano in 20, our...
20% of what?
20% of their volcanic eruptions. I'm not exactly sure what they're comparing that to, but ours is 10% less, so woohoo.
The other extra bonus from volcanic eruptions is they tend to come with some warning of some kind.
Sure. Well, interesting enough, the volcano that erupted in the 1750s near Terrace, it has been generally suggested that this volcano was triggered by an extremely large earthquake known as the 1700 Cascadia earthquake with a magnitude of 8.7 to 9.2. And this earthquake caused a volcano. Now, unfortunately for us, an earthquake is something that's far more likely to happen.
Earthquake of doom!
And you get far less notice.
Unfortunately, far less notice.
Unless, of course, you happen to be Italians, because as you guys are probably following...
Oh, yes.
In the courts right now are mm-hmm. a bunch of geologists in Italy who are being accused of being delinquent... No, what was the word? Well, they're being charged for not warning people that an earthquake was coming.
Yeah.
Bastards. But we won't be charged with that because we're warning people that an earthquake is coming.
That's right. So, in fact, you know, growing up in the Vancouver area, I often heard the warnings of the big one, an earthquake that would level the city and liquefy Richmond. I always kind of thought this was media hysteria, and I thought, that's not going to happen. That's silly. But then I did some research, and I realized, it actually is going to happen. That's too bad. Now, as most people know, earthquakes are caused by plate tectonics. And interactions between these tectonic plates creates friction and stress, and this is a form of potential energy, which can ultimately lead to strain or deformation of the crust, which is the principal cause of earthquakes. Now, unfortunately for us, BC is located along the Pacific Ring of Fire, a volatile region of active volcanoes and shifting tectonic plates. And unfortunately, Vancouver is located right above two tectonic plates, the Juan de Fuca plate and the North American plate. What this means is that we could be looking at a megathrust earthquake, and these megathrust earthquakes occur at subduction zones where one tectonic plate is forced under another. And due to the shallow dip of the plate boundary, which causes large sections to get stuck, these earthquakes are among the world's largest. Now, the megathrust earthquakes generally exceed 9 point on the Richter scale. And in fact, since 1900s, all six earthquakes of magnitude 9 point or greater have been megathrust earthquakes. And that's what we're looking at here.
So just to talk a little bit about what you were saying about the shallow angle. So if you have one plate that's sort of diving under another, and it's quite a steep angle between the two of them, then you're not actually going to have that much surface area. Comparatively, that is touching between the two plates. And so it's able to move with relative ease and moves in sort of little slips. As you have little stuck, things get a little bit stuck, and then it's not actually that much friction because of the lower surface area to overcome that stickiness. And so you get sort of little movements at a time. Whereas, as you were saying on our plate boundary with this very shallow angle, then you have a lot of solid surface area of one plate and the other that's contacting each other. And this, of course, causes much greater friction and causes the need for greater force to move these stuck bits that move much further and with much more force. So, yeah, that's just right. Sort of some of the physics behind those mega thrust quakes.
And the bad thing for us is that the Juan de Fuca plate and the North American plate are doing just that.
Oh, yes, they are.
That's
well,
right.
Is this just another example of Americans not getting around the Spanish? I mean, sorry, I'll shut up.
Yeah, thanks. So this is what caused the massive earthquake in the 1700s, the Cascadia earthquake. Now, is this actually likely to happen? And I did some research, and apparently the consensus among experts is that over the next century, there is a 1 in 10 chance that the big one will hit in the province. So that's scary. Now, part of the reason it's so likely that there's going to be an earthquake is that the Pacific Northwest has a number of different plate boundaries that could prove problematic. So we have the destructive plate boundary, which is the Juan de Fuca and the North American plate subducting. And this is The Wondafuka Plate stretches from sort of just above Vancouver Island down to Northern California. We also have a divergent boundary, which is caused by the Explorer Plate, which is was once a piece of the Wondafuka Plate until it broke off. And it's about 241 kilometers west of Vancouver Island. And that plate is also potentially causing problems. Then there's another problem, and that is a transform fault, which is running along the west side of the Wondafuka Plate between the Pacific Plate. And so given that you have all these potential problems, we sort of are in a perfect storm for earthquake disaster.
I think actually you're pointing out one thing, if someone's really quite interesting, when we tend to think of tectonics and plate boundaries, we tend to think of it as just some sort of nice, neat line between the Pacific Plate and the North American Plate. And there's like, you know, you can almost take a ruler to it or something and draw it. Where actually a lot of these areas are multiple plates, multiple fractures. It's like literally you took two pieces of glass and you slammed up together and you got all these little cracks and fissures in that, which is what a lot of the West Coast, well, most of the tectonic areas look like, which is why there's so much instability there, because it's just not a simple two things pushing against each other. There's a lot of other extra characters involved.
Oh yeah, like I mean the plate under the Pacific Ocean is expanding, and the Wondafuka Plate used to be part of a very, very big one that was crushed between the North American Plate, and it's so if you go up further north, it's all kind of shattered. And you got all these little plates, and then of course you have the volcanic activity, that sort of that's the ring of fire thing. So it's a very volatile area, and you know, looking at sort of what will happen when this earthquake comes, unfortunately Vancouver is in kind of a bad spot.
Actually, I thought Vancouver wasn't such a bad spot. It's Richmond is.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, Richmond and Delta. Because they're built on lowland sediment.
A city named Delta?
Yeah. They weren't very creative back then. It will either liquefy or get buried in mud.
Liquefy is an interesting term, Ethan. What I could define it, but I'll give you a chance.
Well, from what I understand, the ground is going to turn to liquid.
It's such an interesting mechanism.
Yeah, essentially the particles that form the solid surface start vibrating, and literally water that's in the subsurface go in between and act as a lubricant between the particles, essentially turning solid ground into anyone?
Liquid.
Yeah.
It can also happen when the particles are a specific shape. So if you can picture a house of cards that's made from cards and it's standing in a structure, and maybe that's sort of what the soil looks like. And when it starts shaking, even without the addition of extra liquid, when those cards collapse on each other, all of a sudden they slide all in the same direction. And so the ground itself becomes mobile.
Again, if you go to YouTube and you look up some of this, you can see some areas. I think this is in Tokyo, where it's like you have solid pieces of concrete and you can see it's like almost geysers of what is essentially dirt coming out because of this liquefaction.
Yeah, it'll be really fun to watch our home get destroyed. The other sort of...
Where do you live again, Richard?
I don't know. The other sort of depressing thing is that a lot of Vancouver buildings that were built pre-1970s aren't earthquake-proof, or at least not proof of a 9-point megathrust quake. In particular, St. Paul's Hospital will crumble to dust. Obviously, that's sad. A lot of the newer buildings that Vancouver has seen sprout up probably are earthquake-proof. But again, we sort of have a lot of old buildings. And as I was reading sort of all the things that can go bad with this, apparently our water supply is not well protected. So if there's lots of fires that break out, we won't have any water to put the fires out with.
Well, excuse me, ocean?
Yeah. Yeah, that big wave that will just... we'll be okay.
Well, we'll talk about tsunamis in a future episode, but...
Well, see, that's the thing. At least we're not the only ones who will be suffering. This earthquake will produce a massive tsunami, and Japan, Alaska, possibly the coast of America, will all get drenched. So it's a disaster waiting to happen. I can only tell you now to run, and run as fast as you possibly can.
Actually, to be the sensible one here for a change, there are some things you should be aware of.
That is a
change. Yeah, I know. just for your own information, again, you should look this up and get more confirmed or more substantial information. But what do you do if there's an earthquake? If you're indoors, drop to the ground, take cover, right? Hold on to something. Stay away from glass windows, the outer doors. Stay in bed. So don't try and run out of the building unless it's a... Well, you're not supposed to run out of the building, even though that's sort of popular myth. Because odds are, as you're running out of the building, you will trip, fall, and actually cause more injury than you would on most forms of earthquakes.
So only run out of the building if you're very sure-footed.
Yeah. Or if you happen to be right next to the door. I mean, if you're in the hallway and the place starts shaking, I don't think you'd be crazy to run out. This is one thing. This is from the FEMA's website, and I don't know who would do this because I hear this about fires and everything. If you're really that stupid, don't use the elevator. If you're indoors, elevators are not a go area. So, but if you're outdoors, stay there. Move away from buildings. Move away from anything that might fall on you. If you're in a moving vehicle, stop the vehicle. Don't try and run it through. Some of these seems quite obvious to do, but you never know. If you are trapped underneath debris, don't light a match. Don't move about too much. Try and cover your mouth with a handkerchief. And, well, hopefully you're near something that makes a noise, like a pipe or something, and tap to signal. If you have your cell phone handy, that's one of the new miracles that our ancestors didn't have. Again, there'll be a link onto what is sort of the official responses to do in the event of these emergencies on our blog, for those who want to know.
And just from a very human, non-centric point of view, I'd just like to point out that the fact that this is even a risk, it says something about our planet and how, you know, this is really geological, active Earth roaring. And that the fact that our Earth is geologically active and not dead, like places like the moon, means that we can actually sustain the types of patterns and activity and life that we do on our planet today. So we here in Vancouver and Richmond and Delta might not be in the best position earthquake-wise, but by gosh, these help out the planet.
And this is Dawn saying the planet is amazing.
Well, you know, it's an interesting point. We perhaps there is a tendency to kind of hope this just will never happen, but we should be good citizens about this, and we should make sure that our politicians are in favor of earthquake-proofing our city so that it doesn't get swallowed up by the earth.
I thought you were going to say in favor of earthquakes.
No.
And don't fall too much into the, you know, but it doesn't make economic sense for us to plan on something that may not happen. I may not grow old, but at some point I'm sure it's going to happen. So sure, a little investment now is probably much better off than pretending it's never going to happen.
Exactly. Well, we're pretty much out of time here on the show, so why don't we go to our skeptical highlights?
I've got a wonderful skeptical highlight, as I always do. It's called 1 Minute Physics. It's a collection of videos and animations that take on various topics. For example, not last week, but the week before, they have How Do We Know We Live in a Three-Dimensional Universe? Basically explores the concepts of multi-dimensions and show how you can actually kind of test that we live in a 3D world. Where can you see all this? Again, there'll be a link on our website, but www.newscientist.com/blog/nstv/1-minute-physics. Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Well, I have a skeptical highlight that people already probably know about, but James Randi, the founder of the James Randi Educational Foundation, is doing a Canadian speaking tour. The tour starts Thursday the 22nd in Vancouver at the Denman Cinema. Randi will also be speaking in Kelowna, Calgary, Edmonton, Saskatoon, Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal, and Halifax over the next 9 days.
And you get a stamp if you go to all of them.
Yeah. So if you're in one of those cities, check it out. You can find all that information at www.cficanada.ca. And I encourage you to see Randi speak. He's a fantastic speaker.
So my skeptical highlight is the new movie Contagion. And yes, I know it's Hollywood, so we take things with a grain of salt. But actually, I saw it this weekend, and there's some pretty interesting underlying themes. Before I saw the movie, I heard an interview with one of the scientists who consulted for the film. And she said she had a few interesting conditions that she would only work on it if we're met. Firstly, the virus couldn't come from space, so it had to be somewhat realistic. Nor could it come from Africa. She felt that there had been enough demonization happening there. And the problem couldn't be allowed to be solved quickly and easily after a single scientific discovery. So basically going for some realism as well as trying to not scapegoat certain bodies. And specifically also the virus could not be an escaped experiment, i.e. there could be no demonizing of scientists a la Deep Blue Sea. And actually, during the movie, they even throw in some sensationalistic pseudoscience demonization in a specific character, and incorporate some concepts that, although they're presented in a kind of worst case scenario way, were real true elements of a viral epidemic. I cannot speak. My tongue is in knots.
End of the show.
So basically, I found that it was not your run-of-the-mill infectious apocalypse movie, but had some interesting things to say and some things to think about.
I'm convinced Contagion will go viral on the movie network.
Oh.
Nice. Oh. Well, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Jenna saying the real world, not Don, is amazing.
Nicely I'm real. Said.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns.